from the Mountain Broadcast Center, this is Take Two, me Martinez. It's safe to say that California is a friendly and politically safe space for Democrats, except for maybe one of the presidential nominee frontrunners, who has turned down visiting the state twice now. We'll get into that. Plus, considering that Southern California is always in danger of having terrible wildfires, we've been relatively fire-free so far this summer. Find out why ahead on Take Two. Stay with us. From 89.3 KPCC, this is Take Two. I'm Amy Martinez. Thanks for choosing us on your Friday afternoon. We're going to get just right to it right away. We're going to kick off the show, as we do most Fridays, with some state of affairs. That's our weekly peek at politics in the Golden State. And this week, a new poll shows 4 out of 10 Republicans would like to see President Trump have even more influence over the GOP. Meanwhile, Governor Gavin Newsom says SoCal must plan for 1.3 million new homes in 10 years. We'll hear why that's easier said than done. Zach Corser is back with us this week. He co-directs the Policy Lab at Claremont McKenna College. Welcome back, Zach.
Happy Friday. Great to be back.
Also with us, Marisa Lagos, political reporter for KQED. And Marisa is at the Democratic National Committee meeting in San Francisco. Marisa, welcome to you as well.
Hey, thanks for having me. Sorry about the noise in the background.
You know, tell those Dems to be quiet. We're doing a show here.
They are fired up.
You've got my stamp of approval on that. All right, so some polling out of USC and the LA Times took a look at how people are feeling about politics. So, Marisa, what were some of the highlights that stood out to you?
Well, you know, it's interesting. This was a national poll, and they really found that there are about 40% of Republicans who are, you know, backing Trump full-heartedly, not just him, but sort of his brand of politics, this populism. And then things get a little more complicated, right? So you do have Republicans who are not as thrilled with him. And I think with independents, it gets even more interesting, a lot of consternation, you know, about sort of what his reelection could mean. So I think broadly it just shows that, you know, while in some ways it feels like 2020 is Trump's to lose, there are some margins there for Democrats to really cut in on. And I think that's going to be up to these candidates I'm watching today in terms of making that case.
And Zach Corser, I'm sure a few eyebrows were raised when it came to support for the populist direction of the party. Is it at all a surprise to you that so many people are still in that camp?
I mean, not really, because I think this is all part of a continuing trend about the Republican Party. If you look at the demographics of the party over the last 15 to 20 years, you see that it's growing older. It's becoming more male. It's certainly becoming more rural. And, you know, the people who identify as being Republicans tend to be less and less college educated or more. So the party itself has changed quite a bit. And I think that change has been accelerated during this, you know, this moment of Trump. And so, you know, it's not as you can't think of the Republicans as kind of a static group. I think there's some people who are heading for the exits, or you know, either have done so or are on their way, who have been traditional Republican adherents. And I think that's going to be really tough for Trump. It kind of really depends on the electoral college math. You know, where are these people in which states? Because in 2016, you know, it's about 80,000 votes really altogether in certain states that created that electoral phenomenon for Trump. So this is a very marginal game. It's a game of inches, not miles. But the Republican Party, I think, is shrinking.
You know, just yesterday we spoke to Assemblyman Chad Mays about the crossroads the California GOP is facing. And he says many of his colleagues are really in denial about how dire the situation really is.
In 1995, 96, if I remember correctly, we had 41 members of the legislature that were Republicans. Today, we're now down to actually 18. There's a vacant seat, but 19 seats out of a body of 80. And the reason we're where we're at today is because less and less Californians want to stand for what Republicans believe in. And if we don't get our act together, we won't be at 19. We'll be at 5.
Marisa, how do you think this data bodes for Republicans hoping to cling to power in California?
Well, you know, I think that tracks with kind of what we've been seeing, which is that, you know, some of what is happening nationally around, especially when you talk about this sort of immigration conversation among Republicans, is really happened here in California 25 years ago. And so, and that did lead under, you know, former Governor Pete Wilson and Proposition 187 to try to take public benefits away from undocumented immigrants. It did help lead to a backlash, and it wasn't immediate, but it did build this bench that we're seeing really running the game, especially among Latinos in California who are now, you know, in statewide office, Speaker of the Assembly for the last couple terms. And so I think that, you know, what Chad Mays is saying isn't just one flavor of politics. It is sort of a warning shot. But you know, politics can also change quickly. And so I think that what's interesting to see here is how Mays has really tried, and some other folks with him, to get out in front of this and say, hey, let's talk about the values that we think voters do agree with us on, whether it's, you know, more conservative spending and fiscal conservancy. And they've really been shunned by the party leadership, both in California and nationally. And so, you know, we'll see. What I think is going to be interesting is whether people like Chad Mays stay with the party if this continues.
I asked him that a million different ways, and he said for now he is sticking with where he's at. So he didn't, but I was trying. Believe me, I was trying.
Yeah, we've all been trying.
Yeah. In fact, to be fair, Chad Mays did make the exact point that Marisa made. It goes beyond what Trump has done in the last few years. He said it's something that they've been tracking a long time. But we have a short memory. A lot of people have a short memory, Zach, and most are going to point to President Trump and that effect.
Yeah, that's true. But at the same time, I mean, there's been some really historic things happening in California when it comes to the Republican Party. You know, if you thought Republicans in California, you always thought Orange County. That was the one safe bastion of Republicanism. And we saw in the 2018 election, Republicans get wiped out in Orange County. And that's a really bad sign, because I think a lot of the money, the sort of spiritual home of the Republican Party in a lot of ways, is in Orange County, California. And you know, it's shrinking, and this hasn't happened. You know, they voted for Hillary Clinton in 2016. That hadn't happened since the Great Depression. So I do think this is more than, you know, a shift or a historical accident or things are going to come back. I think Republicans are telling themselves that. They're imagining a post-Trump moment where they can come back and say, you know, we see a new reform agenda ahead. But I mean, there's been a lot of damage done to the brand name in the meantime.
We're talking State of Affairs with Zach Corser. He co-directs the Policy Lab at Claremont McKenna College. Also with us, Marisa Lagos, political reporter for KQED. Marisa, I did the whole just between you and me, Assemblyman Mays. I did that whole thing. No one else is. It's just me and you. He still wouldn't bite. He wouldn't bite one way or the other. Now, despite the support that President Trump appears to have, it's worth mentioning he won by a rather slim margin, about 80,000 votes in three key states. How are Democrats feeling about their chances this week heading into their national committee meeting in San Francisco, where you are at right now?
Yeah, I mean, it was interesting. You know, we saw Seth Moulton, the representative from Massachusetts, announce that he's dropping out. And he warned in his speech this morning that, you know, Donald Trump can be beat, but it's going to be harder than a lot of you think. You know, I think that what's happening here in this room is really indicative of the debate that's happening around kitchen tables and in party, you know, state parties around the nation, which is how far left should this party go? Who should they be appealing to? You know, and as you pointed out, the real battleground will be a handful of states that Trump was able to take last time. And so I think that, you know, we are hearing more of the sort of narrative that, like, Biden isn't here, but he put a video out to the delegates here saying, you know, whoever the nominee is, I'll support them. We are hearing more of that, I think, at least some feigns toward unity. But let's be honest, we're a little under 6 months from the Iowa caucuses. This is still a race with more than, you know, almost two dozen people in it. 10 people have made the debate stage for September. It's still messy, and I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing, but there is definitely a sense here. I think that, you know, we've been hearing over the last few years of fear that Democrats really are worried that what happened in 2016 could happen again, and I think that's where the agreement ends, right? Because how you fix that is really what they're trying to make the case to, and each candidate obviously has kind of a different approach on that.
And Marisa, you mentioned Joe Biden is not there. He is in the race still. for the Democratic presidential nomination. I mean, even Tupac at Coachella had a hologram. I mean, why couldn't Joe Biden send a hologram of himself just to show that he was in California? This is starting to raise a few eyebrows now, right?
I mean, judging by the audio quality here, I'm not sure that they have the technology of the DNC for a hologram. I think that Biden's making a calculation that his time would be better served in some of these early voting states where he can actually connect with voters, and, you know, that he thinks that even though California has an earlier primary, what happens in Iowa and New Hampshire heading into Super Tuesday is going to really impact voters more than being at something like this. You know, I do think that there's a question, and I think that it speaks less to necessarily whether California is getting enough attention from Joe Biden and more to this question of who do Democrats stand for? Who do they represent? Who should they be fighting for? What should their message be? All the things we were talking about. I mean, the bottom line is in 2020 November, this state will go blue, but how excited will activists be here if they feel like the front runners aren't paying attention to them. You know, we should mention that the other folks who are polling the highest, Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders, Kamala Harris, they're all here. So they're going to be making their case directly to these folks. But, you know, this is the DNC. It is the National Committee. So, yes, it's California, but it's also about the sort of the insiders in a way. And I think that Biden's calculating that he could do more good on the ground in New Hampshire.
And, Zach, to be fair, Biden has spent some time in California. But if I were the advisors for anyone else, I would point out that he is not here today and now. But it raises the point, right? Biden has been campaigning on a more moderate platform. Meanwhile, everyone else seems to be shifting to the left. I mean, what's your take? Is there anything to be gleaned off of his absence?
I think this is a strategic move. You know, California's moved their primary up to March, so they're early in the calendar. And we all know that this year in particular, like many other years, it's going to be very front-loaded. That March primary with California is going to have lots of voters. And what successful presidential contenders try to do is build momentum. And part of building that momentum is having strong starts right out of the gates. And where do you do that for a Democrat? You do that in Iowa and you do it in New Hampshire. And so he's in New Hampshire because, frankly, I think he's shoring up his support there. Bernie Sanders, you know, right next door in Vermont, has a lot more name recognition and, you know, depends on the poll that you look at, but they're kind of neck and neck there. It's also worth mentioning, too, that Mayor Pete is not in California. He's also made a strategic decision to go to New Hampshire. You know, clock's running down, and I think they want to shore up their numbers and really focus, assuming or hoping that, you know, in the divided, you know, resources that they have, that if they devote it to those earliest states, then they're going to develop that momentum later on. And California is going to say, oh, here comes a winner.
All right, let's get into one more thing before we go. Marisa, Governor Newsom says that Southern California must plan for 1.3 million new homes in 10 years. And we're going to dig into this a little bit later on the show. I want to get your take, though. According to a Brookings Institution researcher, it cites that that often stand in the way of denser housing, cities that often stand in the way of denser housing. Now, using history as our guide, what kind of pushback do you think Gavin Newsom will face from city leaders?
Yeah, I don't think we needed a Brookings Institution study to tell us what we already know, which
are you there?
This fight is really happening between, you know, state at this point with Newsom really trying to push local governments to zone more densely, and a lot of pushback, especially, you know, from more suburban areas. So I think the big city mayors, San Jose, San Francisco, LA, are saying, yeah, we want that. What about everyone around us? And, you know, the cities and counties are not happy. I mean, I think what's different for the first time really in my lifetime is that you have a governor who's made clear that he cares about this and he's willing to push them. I think the question now comes, how will he do that? How hard will he do that? And what kind of pushback will he get? But, you know, you do have lawmakers in both houses of the legislature who consider this a priority. And so while I think the most sort of what people would call extreme bill on this did die, that Scott Wiener bill this year, I think we're going to see that come back. And I think there's a good chance we might see some of that actually come back with the governor's office behind it.
Marisa Lagos co-hosts the podcast Political Breakdown for KQED. She's at the Democratic National Committee meeting in San Francisco. Zach Corser co-directs the Policy Lab at Claremont McKenna College. Zach, Marisa, thanks a lot. You too.
Always
have
a
great weekend. Thanks.
All right. Have you noticed so far this year, Southern California is relatively wildfire free? Believe me, I am not complaining about this one bit, not at all. But I am wondering why. I mean, I kind of thought all the benefits of having all that rain this past winter would have dried up by now. Coming up, find out why we've escaped wildfire's wrath so far. That's next when Take Two continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm A. Martinez. As you may have heard in our earlier segment, Southern California needs to lay the foundation to build 1.3 million homes in 10 years. That's the directive from the state in order to address California's housing crisis. There is a problem, though. That's three times the number that local officials in SoCal agreed to zone for. So how do we meet the state's demands? To answer that, we have Richard Green, Lusk Chair of Real Estate at USC's Price School of Public Policy. Welcome back, Richard.
Thanks. It's good to be with you.
All right. What was your reaction upon hearing what Governor Newsom and state officials want locals to build?
Well, I think what they want is the right thing, and I think what they want is doable. If you look at paces of construction in other parts of the world, that we certainly could feasibly build 130,000 units a year for 10 years in Southern California. But I also thought the politics of it would be very difficult, and it would be hard for them to get people to agree to do it, and particularly municipalities to agree to do it.
So, okay, politics aside, then let's talk about how this could work. Just looking at LA, what are some of the barriers? Some of the barriers that are in place that might make this harder than what people might want it to be?
So the first thing is, if you look at the city of LA, and I don't want to pick on the city, because actually LA as a city does better than the region as a whole in terms of building housing. But nevertheless, the city of Los Angeles has a zoning code that was promulgated in 1946 when the San Fernando Valley was largely orchards. And the population of Los Angeles was less than 2 million people. The city of Los Angeles now has about 4 million people. And so that zoning code was overwhelmingly a single-family zoning code. So about 80% of lots in Los Angeles are zoned for single-family houses. And this makes it quite unusual among very large cities around the world. And then beyond that, in the 70s, there was a proposition called Proposition U that was passed that led to downzoning of many parts of L.A. So even that zoning capacity that was put into place immediately after World War II got reduced. And so we have, there's a fellow who up at Berkeley who wrote his PhD dissertation at UCLA named Greg Morrow, who showed that in 1960, LA was zoned for about 10 million people, and now it's zoned for a little over 4 million people, and we are at 4 million people. So we are basically have almost entirely used up our zoning capacity.
Well, can it be rewritten? Can that zoning code that's, what, 70 years old be rewritten?
It can, and what Mayor Garcetti has called for is a rewrite, new general plans for the city of Los Angeles that have to be rewritten by, I think it's 2023 or 2024, something like that, so in the not-too-distant future. And the thing about L.A. is, because of the way it is, it has 35 neighborhood plans. A downtown plan is being written as we speak, but ultimately you're going to have new plans for all 35 neighborhoods. And how those plans look is going to determine a lot about the shape of LA in the future.
That's a lot of rewriting. What about environmental regulations?
So, well, ironically, California has an environmental regulation called CEQA, which is for the California Environmental Quality Act, that was passed in the 70s. And like a lot of things, its intentions are wonderful, but there are some issues in execution. It's been improved a little bit in the last couple of years. But fundamentally, the problem is this. If you build anything large, like a large apartment building in Southern California or anywhere in California, you need to produce an environmental review for that. And then people can challenge that environmental review. And these reviews are often challenged. And that extends the length of time that it takes to get anything built in California. And from the standpoint of an investor, time is money. So if a project that takes, say, a year to do in Texas takes 5 or 7 years to do in California, that automatically makes it a much more expensive process here in California. And again, it's improved, but ironically, it used to be sort of development at the edge of the city was easier to do because there weren't neighbors to complain, which is environmentally bad, whereas infill development, which is environmentally much better, would face these challenges.
Would waivers work there? Would waivers on those regulations work there?
They do. They would. And actually, again, because of state laws that have been passed in last couple of years, there's a new feature of Los Angeles called transit-oriented communities that allow for greater density and sort of sidestep the requirements of CEQA because of modifications to CEQA that have happened in the last couple of years. And if you look, a lot of the new construction that's happening in LA are happening around these TOCs.
What about, okay, let's just say the path is clear. What about workers, finding enough workers to make those homes, finding developers that want to put shovels into the ground?
Yeah, so that's a great question. And it's to some extent a chicken and egg question. So one of the problems we face is because it's so expensive to live in California, if you're a construction worker, it's not appealing to live in California vis-a-vis a place like, say, Phoenix. In Phoenix, actually, rents and house prices are rising pretty quickly, too, but they're still much, much lower than they are in L.A. So if you're building houses on a construction laborer's pay, you can own yourself a really nice house in Phoenix, where that's very difficult to do in L.A. I think one of the things we need to think about are, so we passed a law in the city called JGAJ in 2016. And one of the things it calls for is for dense development requiring, other than TOC stuff, local workers. And that the definition of local is pretty specific, within 5 miles of the project for some of them, within the city limits of Los Angeles for others. And the fact is, because LA is so expensive, it means it's hard to find workers. And so thinking about making it easier to find those workers is going to be a critical part of this. And as for investors and developers, I think, again, making the process more predictable and speeding it up would make LA a more appealing place to invest in development than it is right now.
And we didn't even get to NIMBYism either. Richard Green, Lusk's chair of real estate at USC's Price School of Public Policy. Richard, thanks a lot.
Always good to be with you.
After living through two of the most destructive wildfire years on record, it feels kind of strange to have reached August and not have been covered in smoke. Here to talk about why there have been more fires is KPCC's science reporter, Jacob Margolis. Hello, Jacob.
Hey.
All right, it's not like we've been completely without fires. The spot fires have popped up. Structures have been lost in places like Redding, which is currently burning. But overall, it has felt tame, I gotta say. So am I imagining things, Jacob, or is something going on here?
You're not imagining things. I mean, especially coming off of the hellish years that we just came out of. Like, this summer has actually felt kind of refreshing, and it's not just in your imagination. So in terms of temperature, LA County, our June and July were cooler on average than the previous 2 years. So June was 1.3 degrees cooler than last year. July was 5.2 degrees cooler than last year. And all of that kind of adds up, especially temperature, as well as the wet year that we had that we've had so far. All of that adds up to lower the fire risk a bit.
And the moisture levels. How high are those moisture levels, and where are they being measured?
Yeah, so up in the mountains, there are different organizations that go out and test plants like chamise and manzanita, and they kind of figure out how moist they are throughout the year. And so if you look at this year, at the chart from this year, like back in through the rainy season, you know, those numbers went up and up and up and up and up, and they slowly have been declining since things have been heating up kind of steadily over time.
You drying know, out, less sort rain. Of?
Yeah, they've been drying out a bit, but they're still not at the critical levels that we would expect to see or that we have seen over the last couple years. They are able to burn. That is, you know, we can't say that that's not going to happen, but they are a little less dry than in previous years. And right now, as spot fires do pop up, you know, we've been lucky that there haven't been any super duper major fires like in previous years. Firefighters are really able to kind of tamp them down and put them out. And so we've been lucky, but that is so far. That does not mean that the rest of the year we're going to be as fortunate.
Well, that's what I was going to ask, because I'm wondering, okay, yeah, it's been good so far. We've been really lucky, but how long before we have another problem?
So the big thing that I'm watching for is when the rainy season comes along. So like the Thomas Fire year, right? Huge, destructive, one of the biggest fires in California's history. Our rainy season didn't come along until early, mid-January. And so by the time October, November rolled around, there were really hot temperatures, all that vegetation had really dried out, like any moisture that had been saved from that previously rainy kind of part of the year was completely completely gone and it was ready to go. And so this year, if we do get to, say, December or January, that rainy season hasn't shown up and temperatures continue to increase, you know, we could be looking at something similar. You just don't know.
Thing is, we've been talking about fire here, Jacob, but it all goes back to water, doesn't it? Eventually, it all just comes around to how much water we have as a state.
Yeah, and as this climate crisis continues to progress, you know, those rain patterns can continue to kind of swing between extremes of extreme drought and then short periods of extreme bursts of wetness. And the one constant that we will have are increasing temperatures over time. And we might have slightly cooler years like this year, but this year is still above average in terms of temperature for us here in Southern California. And July was the hottest month on record for the entire globe. And so don't think that just because we had one kind of mellow fire season so far, that it's all going to be okay from here on out. We have to be vigilant and we have to be careful.
That's KPCC science reporter Jacob Margolis. Jacob, thanks a lot.
Thanks, A.
All right, I come from a family of teachers, three aunts, an uncle, and now a younger cousin is a teacher. And whenever we get together, I sometimes hear how they wish parents could be more involved and more engaged in their kids' school life. Now, I know there sometimes are financial or work factors that can limit parents, but other times it's just simply a lack of interest. Coming up, how angry parents at an elementary school in LAUSD got so involved that it actually turned everything around. That's coming up when Take Two continues. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm A. Martinez. 4 years ago, a group of parents from 20th Street Elementary were ready to stage a revolt. Many were convinced the LA Unified School District was failing their neighborhood school based just south of the 10 freeway near downtown. So they ran two separate campaigns to convert 20th Street into a charter school. Well, today, 4 years later, the school is not a charter, but its test scores are now among the most improved in LAUSD. KPCC education reporter Kyle Stokes has a story. Hey, Kyle.
Hi, A.
All right, so why were these parents dissatisfied?
Well, so back in 2014, a lot of these parents had some pretty fundamental concerns. Here's one of those concerns from parent Lupe Aragon.
My daughter, who was on fifth grade, you know, was getting math work of first, second grade students.
And Aragon knew this because she said that her first grade granddaughter was getting similar assignments. And concerns along these lines about academic rigor were really common among the parents. There were also just complaints about cleanliness and safety issues on campus. And then there were the test scores. In 2015, 4 out of 5 20th Street students scored below grade level on statewide tests. And another parent that I talked to said those scores really opened her eyes and convinced her that something needed to be done.
Okay, then how exactly did these dissatisfied parents plan to kick LAUSD out of 20th Street?
Yeah, so remember California's parent trigger law? This is that law that said that if a school isn't performing well, parents could start a petition. And then if more than half of the school's parents sign this petition, the law would let parents trigger big changes like close the school down, replace the entire staff, or convert it into a charter school. And that is what parents at 20th Street tried to do. And this was controversial from the beginning. It was controversial when the law was passed back in 2010. And it was controversial at 20th Street, too. A substantial number of parents thought that converting 20th Street into a charter school just wouldn't solve their problems. Parent Carla Vilchis didn't sign the trigger petition.
I was not with the same mentality that they had, where they just want to be judging and not helping. And I told them, you guys are just making it worse.
And Vilci says she actually lost friendships over her opposition to the parent trigger.
All right, so it sounds like it was pretty divisive. How did the campaign go?
Well, first off, they got help from this advocacy group called the Parent Revolution, which linked the parent trigger effort at 20th Street with lawyers and organizers. And at 20th Street, the organizers actually say they gathered the signatures twice, once during the 2014-15 school year, but then LAUSD convinced them not to turn in those petitions. But when LAUSD didn't make any improvements at the school, then in 2015-16, the parents started gathering the necessary 350 signatures all over again. And this time, the parents didn't back down. They actually turned in their trigger petition. And LAUSD responded by essentially threatening to bog them down in court on some legal technicalities, as the advocates would put it. Now, that really just ticked off the parent trigger supporters. They clearly thought that they could win this fight in court. But they also thought, this court fight's going to take another 2 or 3 years. So what happens to 20th Street in the meantime?
So what do the parents do?
Well, so in July of 2016, the parents agreed to drop their second trigger campaign. 20th Street would remain in LAUSD. It still is in LAUSD. The school would not convert into a charter. But LAUSD agreed to hire a new day-to-day operator for the school and a group called the Partnership for LA Schools. This is a nonprofit that runs 18 high-need LAUSD campuses now. They pool donations, philanthropic support, to pay for some extra services that the school district can't always offer on its own. And this deal has been a real turning point. Under the partnership's management, 20th Street Elementary's test scores have jumped by more than 20 percentage points in both math and in English. There have been other metrics that have turned around, too. And the most remarkable thing about all this to me is that they did it without replacing the teachers. Huh. Much of the staff at 20th Street remains the same today as it was in 2015.
Then 20th Street Elementary goes from the heart of the parent trigger campaign, fast forward all the way to becoming one of LAUSD's most improved schools. Kyle, how did the school pull this off?
That's what I wanted to find out. And that is how I wound up in a bungalow classroom at 20th Street Elementary in a room full of first graders all sitting cross-legged in front of a smart board where teacher Michael Ramirez was leading a lesson.
Today, here's what we're going to be working on, guys.
The class is reading a text called Robots at Work, which is a nonfiction passage.
I hate nonfiction for first grade. I feel like it's hard.
Nonfiction's full of tough words. It can lack the drama of a narrative story. But Ramirez learned in a training, come third grade, these kids will be tested on a lot of nonfiction.
So I kind of took it as a personal challenge, like in first grade, I need to get them ready for nonfiction responses in third grade.
Let's find out what the author thinks. Robots are amazing machines. Okay, we need to figure out how does he convince us of that?
But it's not just the kids who will be learning during class today.
Say good morning to Miss Bahena.
Hi, Miss Bahena.
To Mr. Garcia.
A half dozen fellow 20th Street teachers are sitting in the back of the room taking notes as Mr. Ramirez teaches his lesson.
It's kind of hard to see. Let's read it. This robot greets visitors by talking
and shaking hands.
Let's read the second page.
This scene is from December 2017, just a year and a half after the Partnership for LA Schools began running 20th Street day to day. And I'm in Ramirez's classroom because when I asked school leaders to show me how is it that the partnership is helping to improve 20th Street, they pointed me to this.
All right, so what are some strategies or some main things that stood out to you during this lesson?
Assistant Principal Isabel Nino was watching Ramirez's lesson too. Class is now over, the kids have left the room, and she and the teachers are sharing notes.
See, you can tell it was very evident that rituals and routines were set in place.
LAUSD created Nino's job as part of their deal with the parents. Her role is to help the staff fine-tune their instruction, in small part by leading peer observation sessions just like this among the teachers.
I thought the sentence frames were really well used.
Another colleague liked how Ramirez would ask a question without demanding kids share their answer with the entire class right away.
They had specific think time where they thought on their own. Then they spoke with a partner, They deliver medicine and food.
I want to add what something you said. I think that the robots are amazing because they could shake people's hands.
They spoke with a partner, and then they did the whole group sharing. So there were lots of opportunities for kids to get ready before they were put on the spot.
Did this happen overnight, Mr. Ramirez? Did you?
Yeah, I just started yesterday.
These discussions and Nino's focus on helping teachers fits into the Partnership for LA Schools' broader strategy at 20th Street. The partnership did bring in new math curriculum, some new technology, but overall, UCLA professor John Rogers believes
what's happened at 20th Street is largely the product of the partnership coming in and promoting sustained development of the capacity of educators.
And right there, that quote, A, promoting the sustained development of the capacity of educators. In other words, what John Rogers is saying there is that teachers at 20th Street could just focus on teaching.
All this started after a parent trigger campaign, but this also only happened after parents decided not to file their parent trigger signatures. Does that make 20th Street a parent trigger success story?
Well, Rogers points out that 20th Street improved without any of the parent trigger's more extreme remedies, the remedies that are spelled out under the law, which calls for, you know, a parent trigger school to be closed or converted into a charter school or to have their teaching staff replaced. None of that happened at 20th Street. On the other hand, the parent trigger law did give 20th Street's parents leverage that they needed to force LAUSD to actually implement a deal. And that leverage may be the parent trigger law's legacy, because there have only actually been a handful of parent trigger conversions since the law was enacted in 2010. But there are a lot more examples of schools like 20th Street, where parents use the law as leverage to force school leaders to make changes. So for all the controversy at the parent trigger's inception, these days it really feels like the parent trigger is kind of faded into the background. The law technically still exists. But even organizations like Parent Revolution, which was helping 20th Street to organize, remember, they've kind of shifted focus. They still would do a parent trigger campaign, but their organization is also pushing for broader, more systemic changes that they hope will empower parents.
That's KPCC's education reporter Kyle Stokes talking to us about the history of parent trigger laws in LAUSD. Kyle, thanks a lot.
Anytime.
All right, 1, 2, 3, 4. Folks are getting a little nervous about this trade war. It's been a bad day for the stock market. Dow fell over 600 points. NASDAQ dropped over 200. S&P dropped 75 points. Luckily for you, me, and everyone else, Kai Ryssdal at Marketplace is coming up right after the show in about 15 minutes or so to explain all of it and hopefully offer some good positive news in the future if you've got some money in stocks. That's coming up. And when Take Two continues in about 60 seconds, stay with us. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez. Earlier this month, the government of India made a controversial change to its constitution, stripping the region of Kashmir of its special autonomous status. Before the move, Indian authorities cut internet and phone lines and detained thousands of local leaders. Some Kashmiris here in LA fear for the future of their families and their homeland, as KPCC's Aaron Schrank reports.
I put it on the speaker.
Weeks after the lockdown began, I met a Kashmiri-American woman named Ufi at her home in Ontario. She was still trying to reach her family.
The last I talked was evening of August 4, and midnight August 4, they snapped all the communication links to the valley.
Ufi was born and raised in the Kashmir Valley, inside India's only Muslim-majority state. I won't use her full name because her brother is a politician currently detained in Kashmir. She doesn't want to endanger him.
He's been arrested. The sense that I can make of it is they are trying to detain and arrest all the people who would have spoken up.
Like a majority of Kashmiris, Ufi practices Islam. She says this is the first year her family didn't attend prayers on Eid, a holy day that fell just days after the Kashmir clampdown.
We didn't celebrate Eid this year because of what's going on back home. We were depressed. We had no news about our family.
The holiday was overshadowed by protests here in L.A. And despite the lockdown, thousands also hit the streets in Kashmir's main city. The Indian government claimed the protests never happened, but BBC reporters witnessed Indian security forces firing tear gas and live rounds at protesters. When India gained independence from Great Britain in 1947 and split into Hindu-majority India and Muslim-majority Pakistan, caught in the middle, Kashmir chose to join India, under the condition that Kashmiris could keep governing themselves. Kashmir's autonomy was enshrined in the Indian Constitution until this month when the Indian government scrapped that provision. Here's Ufi again.
I feel it was the ultimate deceit that the Indian government did towards the people of Kashmir.
Not everyone from Kashmir feels this way. I met Amrit Nehru at his dental office in Bellflower.
I'm originally from Kashmir, and I'm here in U.S. for the last 36 years as a dentist. I was a dentist in Kashmir also.
He's a Kashmiri Hindu. He sees the latest move by India as a bold and positive step. So do most in India's Hindu majority. Kashmir is no stranger to conflict. India and Pakistan have fought two wars over the disputed territory. Meanwhile, Kashmir's autonomy has slowly eroded. Clashes between Kashmiri separatists and Indian security forces over the past 30 years have left tens of thousands dead. Most Kashmiri Hindus have fled. More recently, India's Hindu Nationalist Party, led by Prime Minister Narendra Modi, has been promising to strip Kashmir's autonomy and even resettle Kashmiri Hindus like Nehru.
Now, we have been living in Kashmir for thousands of years. It's actually our land.
Modi supporters, including Nehru, argue the move will end separatist violence and bring economic development to all Kashmiris.
They'll be more prosperous being part of Indian state.
When India finally scrapped Kashmir's autonomy this month, it also did away with a very important rule. Until now, only Kashmiris could settle and buy property there.
This was an article designed to protect the unique character of the Kashmiri people.
That's Irfan Nuruddin. He teaches Indian politics at Georgetown University.
For those who would defend it, it has prevented an influx of Hindus in particular from outside of the state being able to come into the state, buy property, settle, and turn what once was a Muslim majority state into a Hindu majority state.
Nuruddin says Modi's unilateral move against Kashmir raises serious concerns about the future of democracy in India. This week, the Indian government said it would reopen schools and switch some landlines back on. At her house in Ontario, Ufi tries the number for her aunt. She's surprised and relieved to hear a ring.
Hello?
Hello, Shofu.
Her aunt picks up.
Hello, Shofu, take two? Huh?
Minutes later, I ask what she's learned.
So she said, yeah, she's fine. I'm fine. Everything is fine. We have food. But outside, we have no information what's going on outside.
Ufi says her aunt describes an eerie calm in the Kashmir Valley, as residents remain mostly cut off from the rest of the world. But the blackout won't last forever, and Ufi worries what her homeland will look like when it's lifted. Covering religion and diaspora, I'm Aaron Schrank.
Let's cleanse our palate and head into the weekend.
I'm KPCC's Leo Duran and A. Martinez. Yeah, summer is sort of over, but not really, because the weather's always great and there are many things to do outside.
Awesome. What is first?
So one of the best food fests is back for the grand 2019 finale. It's the OC Night Market in Costa Mesa. Starts tonight and runs through the weekend. And this is where more than 200 food vendors set up tents. So after the hot summer sun goes down, you can eat some of the craziest, most innovative food you've ever tried. When I've gone in the past before, I've had these things like rainbow-colored dumplings, tacos with melted cheese discs as the tortillas, milk tea with my face printed out on the foam on top. It is nuts. It is very, very nuts. So when you go very, very hungry, and admission starts at $5.
I would never drink you. I would just stare at the phone.
Oh, yeah. That's why we're friends.
All right. Now, so that's something for the tummy. What about for your mind?
Then head to Leimert Park tomorrow. It's for the famous Leimert Park Village Book Fair. First,
This is actually in a really cute pedestrian area, so it's just nice to see. But this is an all-ages fest, and it welcomes authors, poets, and artists from all over. So, for example, Mohammed Mubarak, who's painted some really graceful portraits of people like Nipsey Hussle, Barack Obama, and more, will be there. There are also going to be cooking demonstrations from people like Leila Ali, Ooh. Who has a new cookbook out. There's a lot more, of course, and the best part, it's free.
All right, cool. Now, this weekend, there's also something for history buffs.
Right, so there's this dark piece of LA's history called the Zoot Suit Riots. Yep. They happened in 1943, and it was a series of violent attacks by the police and Navy servicemen against Latinos dressed in these famous Zoot Suits. It's pretty flashy jackets and slacks. So that's only a taste of the history, and you can get more of it with the Zoot Suit Riots bus tour. It's organized by East LA native Shmuel Gonzalez, and you'll be taken to some of the locations where they happened and more. This happens on Sunday afternoon, and tickets are $50.
All right, now one last one. And for this one, you got to put your lips together and blow.
Well, I would, eh? But I am a terrible whistler. That is okay, since I'm not competing in the Masters of Musical Whistling International Festival and Competition. Yeah, that's a whistler.
Oh, my gosh.
So this happens today and tomorrow in Pasadena. There are five divisions of competitors, including live band accompaniment and world championships, plus a whistling school for the unskilled like myself. Some of these events require tickets, which mostly range from $10 to $30. But what is free, A. Martinez? The contest for people new to competitive whistling. Can you whistle? No, that's a no.
that's the best I can do.
That's a good try. Now, there's actually a lot more going on here this weekend. Check out our full list of events on LAIST.com. That is LAIST.com. And you can find me on Twitter at LeoHasACat.
That's KPCC's Leo Duran. Leo, thanks a lot.
See you later, A.
Man, the strength you got to have there. All right, coming up at 3:30, it's The Frame. That's KPCC's arts and entertainment show, and the host of that show, John Horn. Let's hear you whistle, John.
I'm not going to do that. Oh, all right. I don't want to get fired.
Why is it an obscene whistle? There, it's perfectly G-rated. Okay. All right, what do you got on the show today?
The Daily Show, we have a story about a Hollywood divorce between Sony Pictures and Walt Disney Studios. They have Marvel Studios. They came in and helped Sony reboot their Spider-Man franchise. The Spider-Man movie that came out from Sony this year was the highest grossing movie in Sony history.
Yeah.
But Marvel wanted more of the business. Sony said no, so Sony's going to go their own way. We'll see how that works out. My suggestion, probably not so good given the studio's history.
You would think, right, if a partnership is working well, everyone's making money, that you stay with it.
Here's the great part of the story. Sony had a chance to buy all of Marvel before Disney bought it for $4 billion for $25 million back in the late 90s. And they said, who would want Thor? Who would want Iron Man? True story. And they walked away from it. They took Spider-Man, but not anything else.
Yikes. All right. Now, The Weekend Show, Saturday at 2 o'clock. What do you got on The Weekend Show?
We're going to talk with Wesley Morris, who is a great writer. He's a critic at large at The New York Times. And he wrote an essay, part of the paper's 1619 Project, where he looks at black music and how it has been commodified. It's a really interesting conversation. We talk about what is and is not black music. And there's a moment where we play him a song by the average white band.
Oh.
And is that black music? You'll have to listen Saturdays at 2 to find out.
All right. Awesome. That's John Frame and the Horn, KPCC's Arts and Entertainment Show, today at 3:30 and then Saturday at 2. John, thanks a lot.
Thanks, A.
Okay, so John Frame and the Horn, that's a different thing entirely. It's John Horn and the Frame today at 3:30, Saturdays at 2. I don't know what I was thinking. Too much whistling. That's my problem. All right. If you want to listen to today's show, just go to wherever you get your podcast. There we will be ready for your ears. Thanks for listening. Thanks for trusting us with your time. Take 2. We'll be back Monday at 2. Talk to you then.